Hi, my name is Ty, and I'm a real alcoholic. And first off, I want to thank Rick and the committee for giving me the privilege of coming up here to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope with you. Walking around these halls and through the hotel today, you know, I'm struck by something that it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, walking around the different people, that I realized that we really are people who would not normally mix. Yet there exists among us a fellowship that is divinely spectacular. Yeah. My father was a full-blooded American Indian, and he's a Southern Baptist preacher. So I needed a drink real early in my life. And it sounds like there might be some people here who recognize that Baptist religion, because they got a whole lot of sins in that Baptist church. You know? And it seemed like when I was maybe 4 or 5, 6 years old, I found out that there was very little that I could do that was fun that wasn't a sin. And that kind of became my watchword. You know, if it's fun, it's a sin. And if it's a sin, it's going to be fun. So I went out looking for that sin. And I grew up in a lot of different places. My father was an evangelical preacher, so they moved him all around the country. They liked to send him back to places in the Midwest where, like I said, he's a full-blooded American Indian. They'd send him back to places in the Midwest where there are a lot of Europeans, a lot of children, kids with blonde hair and blue eyes, like populate the Midwest. And so they'd send my father out to open a church right out there, and I had 4 brothers and a sister, so there were 6 of us kids. None of us had blonde hair or blue eyes. Where every time we went to, we stood out, you know, like raisins in oatmeal. And I just grew up feeling different, you know, and the main reason was we were different. And but I internalized that in a different way than all of my siblings did, because we were always welcomed, we were always accepted in all of the communities that we went to. There was no problems with being looked down on or you know, prejudiced against. And we always fit right in, but I always felt different. My siblings didn't feel different. We all fit right in, we all played sports, we all fit in with all the teams, but even though we seemed to be accepted, I felt different. And I think that was the precursor of the feelings that I had that finally became relieved by alcohol. But I lived in about 9 different schools by the time I was in the 7th grade. And so I felt I was always the new kid on the block. It just wasn't a feeling. I was the new kid on the block. And so that always made me feel different. But at the same time, it set a pattern in my life that I carried into adulthood, and that was I learned that I could reinvent myself with every new town that we went to. And I always, like I said, I always felt different. I always felt that when I was out with the other kids, I'd make up lies about myself. I'd tell them stories that weren't true just to try and make them think better of me. And pretty soon I'd get to the point to where the lies were unmanageable, where they're going to start getting caught up, where I'd forget what I said to somebody and so we said something different to somebody else, and the lies would start catching up on me. Fortunately, we'd move again so I could start all over. And I carried that into adulthood. As I got into adulthood, I had some very interesting experiences. I had some very interesting jobs. I had a lot of things that I could talk about that, you know, that I did or that had happened in my life that were very interesting to talk about, but that wasn't good enough for me, so I made up more lies and just kept telling more lies. And I had my first drink of alcohol when I was about 11 years old. And we were visiting some people in Canada on some church business of my father's. And so we were staying with these people in their home And whenever we stayed in people's houses, I liked to explore the house, kind of look behind the closed doors and see what they had. And bathrooms were really interesting because they had really different stuff in their medicine cabinets and drawers and everything. So, and I was in this house and I was exploring the bathroom. And I found this cabinet, I opened the cabinet door, and there was a tall brown bottle about this tall with a long, narrow neck on it. Now, I'm about 12 years old at this time, so I've been around enough so I know that there's some sin in that bottle. Because I heard my father preach a lot of sermons about the demon rum and the sin of alcohol and what that did to people. And so I opened that door, and there's that bottle sitting there, and that was the closest I'd ever been to some real-life sin of that kind. And I went back to that bathroom 3 or 4 times, and I'd open that drawer, and I'm just standing there and looking in that bottle, you know. And so I can tell you my obsession with alcohol developed before I ever had a taste of it. And I went back about 4 or 5 times, and finally I got up the nerve to take the top off that bottle, and I took a little drink. And I remember that drink, it just hit my throat. And it was hot, it just burned, you know. And then it just left a warm trail, and it just trickled down just so slow, so warm. And it just trickled down, and it just settled across my soul, you know. And I never had another drink quite that good. But I had a lot of trying to get another one that good. And I went back, I didn't grab that bottle and just pour it down my throat and get blind drunk and stagger around the house and anything like that. But I went back about 4 or 5 times while we were visiting those people and I'd take another little sip out of that bottle. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew that these kinds of bottles were going to be in my life. They're going to be a important part of my life. And so as time went on, about 3 years later, I was freshman in high school, and somehow I managed to get a uniform on the football team. I still don't know how, because I was about 5'2" and weighed about 110 pounds, and I have no idea how I got that uniform on the football team. And Friday night after the first football game, we're having a party out at one of the lakes nearby in town. By this time, we're living in Washington, and rural Washington, and mountains with lakes all around. So we're having a party out by one of the lakes. And they handed me a bottle of beer at that party that had been bouncing around in somebody's trunk in 85-degree weather for about 4 hours. And they popped the top off that beer, that hot beer, and I put it up to my lips, and I took a big slug out of it because I expected it to taste like whatever was in that bottle in Canada. I assumed that was some kind of brandy because it was sweet and warm and good, you know. I tell you, that hot beer hit my tongue, hit the back of my throat, and hit the ground. Came right back out, you know. And when I spit that beer up like that, the first thing I did was I looked all around to see if anybody had noticed me spitting up that beer. Because I was terrified that all those people that were drinking that beer were going to think that I was some kind of a sissy that couldn't drink beer, you know. And nobody seemed to be watching me. They were all busy doing what they were doing. So I took that hot beer, and I just walked around. We were in the park campground, and I'm taking sips out of that beer, and I'm gagging on every sip of that beer. And I take a little sip, and it hit the back of my throat, and it'd be like about a 15, 20-second fight to see whether or not it's going to stay down or come back out, you know. And I'd take a sip out of that beer, and, man, it was just really a chore to get through that bottle of beer. And when I finally got the bottle empty, and I walked by, and they had these 50-gallon drums emptied as trash cans, and I threw that bottle into one of those trash cans, and it rattled around in there, clank, 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 clank in there. And somebody noticed that my bottle was empty, so they handed me another one. I was like, oh, man. So I staggered around there, and I sipped on that beer, and I choked it down. I threw the next one in kind of quietly, but somebody noticed that I needed another one. They gave me another beer. But somewhere about halfway through that third bottle of beer, I noticed the change because I wasn't gagging on it anymore. I put it to my lips and I'm just swallowing the beer. And I finished that beer and they handed me a fourth one, and I got about halfway through that fourth one and I noticed that I was starting to feel just a little bit different than I'd ever felt before. I don't really know how to explain it, but I just felt different than I had ever felt before. And I'm standing at that beer and I remember there was a little strawberry blonde cheerleader that I'd had my eyes on, and she worked at the drugstore making sodas and things like that. Whenever I was in the drugstore and she was working there, I'd be step trembling over displays and knocking down shelves and everything, trying not to look at her. But that night, after I had that end of that fourth beer, and I saw her walking over towards the side of the lake, and I just went right on over. And I said, "Peggy, how'd you like to take a walk down by the lake?" And she said, "Okay." And for the next 30 years, alcohol could do that every time I drank it. See, for the next 30 years, every time I got that alcohol in my body, all those self-centered fears, you know, I just thought I was shy. I thought I was a bashful kind of kid. I found out when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that they call that self-centeredness, see. And I was self-centered, and I was always thinking about me, but alcohol took all that away. It took all those fears away. It made me more than equal with everybody else. It put me a cut above everybody else. And alcohol did that for me for the next 30 years. And I didn't, like I said, I didn't get just blind drunk or anything like that. From the time of my first drink of alcohol, it was 4 years until the first time that I actually got drunk. And the first time that I actually got drunk was after I'd graduated from high school and I'd joined the Air Force and was waiting to be sent out to my camp. And it was the end of the summer in this valley where we lived. And in that valley, there was all kinds of summer work that people came in from different places to do in the orchards and the farms and the ranches and everything. And at the end of the year, it was always kind of a melancholy thing because it'd be usually be a party when everybody was going back to do whatever there was. This was my last year in that valley. And so that end of the summer party was especially kind of meaningful to me. And my buddy and I had scored a fifth of vodka. I don't remember how we did it, but we had this fifth of vodka between us. And that was enough to get me drunk for the first time in my life. And I did it, you know, probably about a pint of beer that vodka that I drank was enough to really wipe me out. And what I remember was that at the end of it, my buddy, he was gone. I don't know where he went, but so I was there and the party was breaking up and there was a cheerleader that had graduated the year before, decided to take me home because she knew that I wasn't going to make it home on my own. And during the summer, I was sleeping on a screened-in back porch, not in the open. And so she took me in and tucked me in into the bed. And then unexpectedly, she got in with me. From that moment on, sex, alcohol, fun, they were all married together. They all were one package, and they stayed one package like that, and like I said, for the next 30 years. And after I got out, after that party, I went ahead and went into the Air Force, and I spent 4 years in the Air Force. Had a successful career. I made more rank in 4 years than anybody made up to that point. At the time, I was a little over, not quite 3 years in the Air Force. I was ranked as a staff sergeant. And there were guys in there that had been in the service for 10, 12 years that were still waiting to get that rank. And I don't know how that happened. I got it. You know, this is just that alcohol was not causing me any problems in my life, you know. I finished that tour in the Air Force and got out. I came to California, went to work at General Motors, down in Southgate. I was working in the engineering department there. I'd been in the engineering in the Air Force, and I went to work in the engineering department at the General Motors plant. And once again, you know, immediately successful. They promised me a promotion and more money. They kept giving me the work that went with the promotion and more money, but they never gave me the promotion and the more money. So, and I kept bugging them about it, and they say, why don't you give me the money? I'm not getting the money. I'm doing the work, but I'm not getting the money. And the superintendent kept saying, we're going to pay you. We're going to give it to you. And so after I got tired of that, so I went down to the LA City Hall and put in an application for the Los Angeles Police Department. And I got accepted. They gave me a date to go to the academy. So I had decided I was going to pull a one-man strike on General Motors, and I went back. No arrogance in my house. I went back and I told the superintendent, I said, look, I said, you've been promising me this a promotion, and I'm not getting it. And I said, so I put it in an application to the police department, and if you don't give me that promotion, then I'm going to leave here and I'm going to join the police department. The superintendent just leaned across his desk and he said, that's going to be a great job for you. I don't want to be a policeman. So I became a policeman. And all my life I've been scared of cops. No. When I was a kid, we used to speed around the highways and everything. We were always looking out for the cops, you know. And so I was terrified of cops, and all of a sudden, next thing I know, here I'm driving a police car down the street. And those old fears were so much, I'd be driving down in a police car, and I'd see a police car coming, I'd look at the speedometer to see how fast I was going. And again, you know, I did good. Now, cops are known to drink now and then. And I was working at the Wilshire Division in Los Angeles, and we had what they called, at the point, that time it was called the Wilshire Choir. And a guy named Joe Wambaugh wrote a book about the Wilshire Choir, which was not like the real Wilshire Choir. The real Wilshire Choir was a bunch of guys that just got at the end of the 3 o'clock in the morning shift, gathered around at Francis Drive-In at Washington and La Brea, and the bars were all closed, so we'd bring our own bottles, and we'd stand around there and have a few drinks and recap the night and things like that. And nobody really got in trouble, no. But then Wambaugh wrote that book and ruined it for everybody, because it was no more choir. So, and I did that job for 5 years, and like I said, I was good at it, got good grades, you know, was able to choose whatever appointments I wanted. And about halfway through it, I handled a case with an insurance company on a big accident thing where the insurance company ended up winning. And so they kept wanting me to go to work for them, to do investigations for them. And it ended up, they were offering me more than twice as much money as I was making on the police department. I worked all weekdays, no nights, no weekends, and very little time in court, and I couldn't refuse that, so I went to work for the insurance company. And I worked for them for the next 13 years. Now during this time, while I was in the police department, I got married. I got married under shady circumstances, I have to say. Because I went to work for the police department, and one of the record clerks that worked there was a very nice, cute girl, and so we started dating, and we were getting fairly serious. And then after we'd been going out for about a year, a girl that I went to high school with and I had birthdays that were just about 6 days apart, so we celebrated our birthdays every year in a single party. And this year, I went to the party, and I had to work that night in the police department, so I got to the party, and my classmate was there, and one of her friends came along, and her friend was a 5'8" blonde lady, willowy, very nice looking, my eyes, you know, like that. And we kind of hit it off, you know. But the problem is, I got this other girlfriend, yeah. And so this is the first time that I was trying to juggle two girlfriends and keep them apart from each other. It didn't work out, mainly because one of them got pregnant. And so we got married, because that's what you did back then. The girl got pregnant, you got married. So we got married, and it turned out to be a fairly successful marriage, especially on her part. We stayed married for 17 years. We ended up, we had two great kids, and but she was the, if I had to interview a whole lot of people to find out the best mother for my kids, I'd have to pick her. She was that good of a mother. And but I, on the other hand, was not that faithful, you know. And I was playing around almost from the very beginning. And even, so after 17 years, and actually after I left the house after about 14 of those years, and because I couldn't put up with what I was doing, so I left the house and I moved into a hotel down in Los Angeles. And by this time, I'd left the insurance department. I was working for this insurance company. I'd been promoted to managing their Los Angeles office and making big money. We had a couple of houses up in La Crescenta, big one up on the hill with the swimming pool and the whole bit. And it looked like the great American dream come true. But every time we'd get there, in my head, I'd be sitting around maybe behind that swimming pool and wondering, what the hell am I doing here? You know, I don't belong here. And I knew that all of this stuff that I was getting that I didn't deserve, and as soon as they figured out that I didn't deserve all this stuff, that they're going to start taking away from me. And so I did what I did was I started divesting myself of all that stuff. And finally I left that house and moved into a hotel down on Wilshire Boulevard. And not long after I left the family like that, I quit that job. And it took me a long time to quit that job because when I went down one Friday afternoon and I called my boss. His office was in Chicago, Illinois. And I called him, I said, Art, I'm going to send in my resignation. I'm going to hang it up here. I don't want to do this anymore. And he said, whoa, Ty, he says, hold on there. He says, don't put anything in the mail. Don't make anything permanent. He says, let me give him a chance to talk about this. He says, will you hold off on that letter until Monday? And he says, so I can talk to you? And I said, okay, I'll hold off on the Monday. But I said, after Monday, I'm going to send it in. And so I went on with my weekend, did what I usually did on the weekend, drank most of the weekend, got back to my office on Monday morning, and I was expecting that he was going to call me from Chicago and try to talk me out of quitting. And when I got to my office, he was sitting in my office already. He'd flown out from Chicago. And so he spent the week with me trying to talk me out of quitting, because he kept telling me, he says, Ty, you're doing a great job here. He says, we don't want to lose you. We want to keep you. So we're willing to do whatever we have to do to keep you. And so by the end of the week, we worked it out where he was going to give me a leave of absence so I could work out the problems that I was having at home and, you know, the rest of the lies that I'd told him. And so he did. He gave me a fully paid leave of absence. Now, if you want to kill an alcoholic, here's a good starting point. You don't have to come in. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to report to anybody. We'll just send the money to your house, and you do whatever you need to do with that money. Then whenever you get ready, you can come back to work. You see, a guy like me, this goes on for 5 months, and after about 4 months, three months, he started calling me and saying, are you ready to come back to work? I said, no, not yet. He'd call me a couple weeks later, ready to come back? No, not yet. And so this went on after about 5 months, and he finally called me. He says, Ty, he says, if you don't come back to work, he says, we're going to have to cut off the checks. He says, we can't just leave you out there like that doing nothing, getting paid. I said, Art, I told you I wasn't coming back when I left. See? Now, see, I'm feeling pretty good about myself because I've been getting all this money for nothing, you know, and I hadn't looked ahead to see what happens if you're not getting this money. So when he said, we can't keep sending this money, and I said, Art, I told you I wasn't coming back. And he said, well, okay. He said, we're going to have to cut it off then. And it took me about 3 weeks, you know, without that money coming in to realize that this ain't going to work. I'm going to have to do something. And so I got in with a bunch of guys that I've been drinking with, you know. And some of these guys had some pretty neat ideas for making money. Now, some of those ideas that they had were kind of borderline illegal, see? And the ones that weren't borderline illegal were completely illegal. So. Who cares? You know? I had an equation. How much money are we going to get? What are the chances to get caught? If that equation worked out, count me in. I didn't care what it was, count me in. And so we did that stuff for about 4 years. You know, and we I mean, it was great work. The hours were short, the pay was good, and we never got caught. But the thing is, at my core, I was still this Southern Baptist preacher's kid. And I still had that belief that I'm not like this. I don't do that kind of stuff. You know, I know what's wrong. And every time we did one of those things, it just ate at my soul just a little bit more, to where finally it got to the point where I was just drinking more and more and more in order to be able to calm my head down enough to do what we had to do. And see, now when you're doing stuff that can get you in trouble and you're drinking to do it, well, let's just say I'm probably the first crook that ever got fired by his partners for me drinking too much. I got fired from a criminal enterprise. And so once again, the money was cut off. You know? And so I learned then that I was willing to do just about anything I could in order to get the money I needed to get along, and that didn't last very long. And I'm just going downhill and going downhill. Finally worked out that after about a year and a half of that, the wife that I was estranged from and the lady that I was living with while I was estranged from her got together, and they did a two-person intervention on me. And my wife was still, we weren't divorced at the time, so she was still carrying me on her insurance at work. And so she, her, and the lady who was a cocktail waitress that I was living with had gotten in touch with one of these recovery hospitals, a care unit at the time, and they had me enrolled to go in this care unit on my wife's insurance. And this was against my will, but they didn't give me any choice on it. You know, it was either this or out on your own. So I went to this care unit and spent 28 days in the care unit and came out kind of feeling revitalized. I hadn't had a drink for 28 days. I was feeling a lot different. You know, I was feeling kind of hopeful and thought that maybe this thing can work. You know, so I went to some sporadic AA meetings. I didn't go as much as they said I should. And so I went, and I went back to work in another job. It was a time when employment was really going well, so I went to an employment agency to see if they could get me a job, you know, an executive recruiter company, to see if they could find a job that fit my talents. And they really liked my background, and the guy liked it so much that he wanted me to go to work with him. So I did. I went to work with him, and we were making a lot of money. And at the end of that, about 3 months there, it was coming up on Christmas, and so we went to have a little celebration for Christmas, and I'm not drinking during this time, so when we walked into the place where they're having the celebration, I stopped at the bar and told them to give me a plain soda. So I took my drink, the plain soda, back to the table where they're drinking, and they were having drinks, and so I'm sipping the soda and getting by with it. But then somebody else went and got another tray of drinks and brought them back. And, you know, they asked me what I was drinking, and I told them gin and tonic. So that's what they brought back. See? So I drank that gin and tonic. And I went home, and I didn't get drunk. And my head told me all that stuff they've been telling me about AA, about one drink does it, that it's the first drink that gets you drunk. I had the first drink. I didn't get drunk. So maybe I just reacted on that stuff. Maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. So I decided I could have a drink now and then. And so I did. I would just get after work, we'd stop and I'd have a drink or two of gin and tonic, and go on home. Nothing going wrong. And then we went to a convention in Palm Springs, where with the office, a whole bunch of people, went to the Palm Springs, and after the first night's meetings, we were sitting around a little campfire outside the hotel and having drinks. And I had four or five drinks. I still didn't get drunk. And I thought, yeah, I got this. I'm mad. I'm okay. And I got back to L.A., and I started stopping in with the boys after work for a few drinks. And within a month, I was getting drunk every night. I was fired from that job. And I was right back at it again. And this started about a three-year period of me getting sober, getting drunk, getting sober, getting drunk. And finally, I ended up by myself. I was in my apartment. I'm in one of the places I'm not working. I got a bunch of money in the bank because I was doing good work when I wasn't drinking. And so I'm in my apartment, and I'm trying to figure myself out. And I got the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous there. Finally, I figured I'm one of those people that just is not going to be able to do this. And I said, so I figured if this, they say I can kill myself if I drink too much, and that's the way I'm going to go. And so I holed up in my apartment and for about 6 weeks, making a conscious effort to trying to drink myself to death. You know. And the problem was that I kept waking up. And one day I woke up, and one more time the bottle was down to about that much, and I got to make the trip. The place where I was living, there was only a block down to the liquor store. I walked down to the liquor store a couple times, at least once a day, sometimes twice a day, to get enough booze to keep me going. So I headed down to the liquor store one more time, and I didn't realize that my body was becoming very dilapidated, you know. And I got about halfway across the street in front of the intersection, right in the middle of the intersection. Headed down the liquor store, and I fell down right in the middle of the intersection. It wasn't the first time that I'd fallen down in that last drunk, but it's the first time I couldn't get up. I tried to get up, and I just kept flopping down and falling down again. I get halfway up and fall down again, and I'm flopping around like a fish out of water in the middle of the intersection. Finally, I crawled out of the street on my hands and knees, and I'm sitting there on the curb and looking back at the apartment and wondering, how the hell did this happen to me? You know, I was a cop. I saw drunks down in the street all the time, down in Skid Row. I knew what they were. They were just hopeless drunks. That couldn't happen to me because I wasn't like that. I wasn't like those people. But there I was, sitting there on the curb, and I couldn't get up. And finally, I crawled up the street on my hands and knees and got to a lamppost, and I pulled myself back up to my feet on my lamppost and walked back and got upstairs to my apartment. There's the bottle of vodka, still had about 3 inches left in the bottom of it, sitting on the kitchen counter. I walked in and I picked up the bottle, I took the cap off it, and I poured it down the sink. Had no thought of doing that. To this day, I don't know what made me pour that bottle down the drink, but I poured the bottle down the drink, and as soon as it was empty, I just standing there at the bottle like that, and I thought, my God, why did I do that? You know, I might have been able to taper off a little bit. I was a good taperer in those days. I'd taper off, and I'd taper on, and I'd taper off. And I knew what was going to happen because I'd quit drinking cold turkey 4 or 5 times during that last period when I was fighting the booze. And I'd quit drinking 4 or 5 times after drinking the way I drink. It's not a fun thing to do. Because when you're drinking 2 or 3 quarts of booze a day and you stop just like that, after about 4 hours, my legs stop working. I can't walk, and I'm crawling around the apartment on my hands and knees. And anything that I put in my mouth, I'm going to throw back up. And I'm going to just be sick as a dog for 6 or 7 days. And I know that because I've done it again before. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm crawling around my hands and knees for 6 or 7 days, only this time there is something different. While I'm crawling around there and hoping I can get enough strength up to get up and do something, I didn't want to be able to get up and get back down to that liquor store and get another bottle. While I was crawling around this time, I was just hoping that I could get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That big book had been open on the coffee table, and it is open to the first chapter of A Vision Called You. A Vision for You. And I look at that, and that first chapter, that first page, page 151, A Vision for You, that first page talks about what happens in those last days of heavy drinking, you know. The good old days are gone forever. There's just a memory. And the pitiful are the four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And that's what I was living. That story told my life on that day. And all I could hope, wanted to do was to get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after about 5 or 6 days, after about 4 days, I was finally able to start eating a little bit of something and start to get a little strength back. And so after about 6 days, I managed to make it down to the Methodist Church at Wilshire and Plymouth in Los Angeles, where there's a meeting down there on Saturday night. And so I managed to get down to that meeting, and there's a little white-haired lady named Sybil was talking at that meeting that night. And after that meeting was over, I'm standing out in the aisle between the two rows of chairs in that meeting, and I'm still shaking, about 6.5 on the Richter scale. I'm standing there like this, and I got the whole room vibrating around me, and I got bags under my eyes down here, and I weighed about 140 pounds because I haven't had anything to eat. The little guy that I'd seen that meeting over and over again, he stood about this tall. And he walks up to me, he looks up to me, he says, "How are you doing?" "I'm fine." I didn't tell him I was fine. No. He looked up at me and he says, "How are you doing?" And I looked back at him and I said, told him three words that no adult human being had ever heard me say. I said, "I need help." And that little guy, he just reached out in the middle of that aisle and he just put his arms around me. He reached about this far up on me. He's just standing there and he's holding me in the middle of the aisle. And he holds me there for about like 30 seconds, and finally he looks up at me and he says, "I will do anything I can to help you stay sober." See? And I had heard people say things like that in these meetings over and over again, you know, and I never believed you for an instant, because the world I come from, nobody does something for nothing. So I always knew when somebody told me that they were going to do whatever they could for me, that they were going to want something back. And I was always afraid that what they wanted back was more than I can afford to give them back, so I wouldn't accept the help that they were offering. But Alcoholics Anonymous is the language of the heart, and that night that man's heart spoke and my heart heard him, because I believed that he would do whatever he could to help me stay sober and that he wasn't going to ask for any paybacks. And for the next 14 years, that man lived up to that promise. Next 14 years until he went to the big meeting in the sky. And while I'm standing there and he's holding me in the room, I said, "Well, what am I going to do?" And he says, "Well, there's another meeting here tomorrow night. Be here." And well, first he told me, I said, "What am I going to do?" And he said, "Well, you're going to take these chairs and you're going to put them in the rack over there." So I did that. I took the chairs and I put them in the rack. And he said, "There's going to be a meeting here tomorrow night. Be here." So after the meeting the next night, and we got done at the meeting, and I said, "Marv, what am I supposed to be doing? I'm supposed to be doing something." He says, "You're supposed to put the chairs in the rack." Yeah. So I put the chairs in the rack, and then the Monday night, there's a meeting at Olympic and Crescent Heights in Los Angeles. He said, "Be there." So I went to the meeting, and after that meeting, they told me that tomorrow night, he says, "We're going to be at Arlington. Be there." I went to Arlington. Now the thing is, whenever he told me to be at one of these meetings, I went to the meeting he said to be there, and he was there. He wasn't telling me to do things that he wasn't doing. He was telling me to do what he was doing. And so after about the fourth meeting, then he told me to meet him at Bob's Big Bird restaurant at Crescent Heights in Wilshire, Crescent Heights in Wilshire. And so I met him at Bob's Big Boy, and we're standing out in front of the restaurant, and across the street was a big Carnation ice cream building. And so we're talking about the program, and he says, "Okay," he says, "I think you actually got through the first two steps." He says, "You admitted that you couldn't do this thing on your own, which is why you came back to AA." And he says, "You asked for help," and he says, "I think you're ready to do step three." And says, "Well, I think, aren't we kind of headed ourselves on that?" And he said, "No," he said, "I think you need to do it." I said, "Yeah, I don't think you can wait any longer." So he took my hand in the parking lot there at Bob's Big Boy, got down on his knees by the parking bumper to say the third step prayer. Like I said, the Carnation Ice Cream building is across the street, and there's all kinds of windows in there, and I knew everybody in that building was looking down at me down there in the street on my knees, and saying, look at this idiot down here on his knees. And I wasn't self-centered or anything. But that's the way I felt. I felt like the biggest hypocrite. I knew that I didn't believe a word of that prayer they were saying. I knew it wasn't going to do a bit of good. But when we got up, for some reason, I felt better. And so I asked him, what do I do now? And he said, you're not doing anything else? He said, go get your book, go to the page where it talks about the fifth step, the fourth step. And he said, and start writing your fourth step. He said, you're not doing anything else, so start writing it. So I went home and I started writing my fourth step. And I was trying to be as honest as I could, and I got into the honesty. And as soon as I got into the honesty, it started hurting. Because when I started getting into the honesty of all these people that I'd screwed over, all the things that I'd done, all the lies and the hurt that I'd scattered around, and it would just get painful, and I'd call him up and I'd say, Marv, I can't do this. And he says, what's wrong? And I says, I'm thinking about all these things that I did, and I was saying, I can't write that down. And he says, why can't you write it down? I said, well, what use it is? I'm not going to be able to read it to you. I said, I won't be able to read this garbage to you. And he said, of course you can't read it if you don't write it down. He said, that's the first thing. He says, you're getting too far ahead. He says, you got to write it down first. Then you can decide whether or not you want to read it to me. And so I started writing it down. I put it all down. And I'd call him over and over again and say, I can't do this. And he'd say, you can do it just one page at a time. He said, just keep writing. And finally, after about 5 days of that, I reached a point where I sat down at the table with my spiral notebook, and I sat down with my spiral notebook, and I couldn't think of anything. And so I prayed about it, and then I started writing again. And there was nothing coming. And so finally, I called him. I said, Marv, I just can't think of anything more to write. And he says, bring it to my house tomorrow morning then. And he says, you read it to me. And so funny thing that when I first thought that I'd never be able to tell him about all this stuff, I couldn't wait to get down and read it to him. And so I got it down to his house, and his wife, as soon as I walked in, she said, I'll see you guys later, and she left. And so I sat there and I read that inventory to him. And fully aware, you've heard over and over again that I was going to thought he was going to toss me out of the house. Yeah, I thought he was going to say, I can't have anything more to do with you. And I thought that you know, somehow it was going to be the end of us working together. He just sat there and listened. He didn't make comments. He didn't say anything else. And when I finally finished, then he said, okay. And we went out of the house and back to the dumpster in the alley behind his house. And he tore about 4 pages out of the notebook, and he tore them up in little pieces, and he threw them up in the dumpster, and he says, there goes 20 pounds of bullshit you can't carry around anymore. And then he tore out some more pages, and he handed them to me and says, tear them up. And I threw them in the dumpster, and he says, there goes 20 pounds of bullshit you can't carry around anymore. And we're tearing that up, and it's funny, after about the third time, when we start throwing that confetti into the dumpster, it just started feeling like the weight was just starting to come off of me. And by the time we got everything thrown in, it was almost like a party, you know. I was feeling happy, I was feeling joyful. And he said, now you go home, and he says, you open the big book to the pages with step 6 and 7, and he says, you do what it says on those pages. And so now, from the time that I was a kid until somewhere through this period in time, I had educated myself out of my father's religion. I'd educated myself out of any kind of religion. I'd educated God out of his existence. There was no God in my world. And so I'd become not only an agnostic and then an atheist, I became an evangelical atheist. And I was out to convince anybody that there is no God. But when he told me what I had to do with step 6 and 7, and I went home and I did step 6 and 7, just like it says to do in the big book, and at the end of step 7, it's got a prayer where I'm supposed to say, and this atheist got down on his knees by his bed to say that prayer out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time since I'd been maybe 10, 11 years old, I thought that my prayer might be being heard somewhere. And from that point on, I knew that this program was going to work. And I continued going through the steps. I had to horrible time with step nine, because I had so many things that I had to do. I had to make amends to my mother. I had to make amends to a lot of people. One of the first amends that was probably the most terrifying was that I owed $1,000 to an Italian bookie where I'd stiffed him on a bet. And those Italian bookies have some very strict interest rates when you owe them money. And I told him, he told me I had to go make amends to this bookie. And I says, Marv, do you know how much interest they charge on what you owe them? I said, that bill is going to be astronomical. And he says, you have to go make the best deal you can, because right now you're afraid of running into that guy. You'll never be able to walk a free man until you're able to put that man out of your memory. So I looked up this bookie. I went back to some of the old hangouts, and I found a guy that was an associate of the bookie, and I asked him, I said, the guy was known as Dago Jimmy. So I asked the guy, I said, do you know where I can find Dago Jimmy? And he says, you want to find Jimmy? He said, Jimmy would like to find you. And I said, yeah, I need to talk to Jimmy. And so he told me, he says, I think he's hanging around the clown room up in Hollywood. So I went up to the clown room, and sure enough, I found Jimmy there. And when I walked in, he kind of jumped back, and I thought, and he looked like he thought, is this guy coming with a gun, or what's he doing? You know, he looked. And so when I told him I needed to settle up with him somehow, and so I told him why. I told him what's going on and why I need to settle up with him. And finally he says, you're serious about this, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I am. I says, I got to do this, I says, or I'm going to end up killing myself. And he says, okay, he says, give me the 1,000, we'll call it even. You know, and that was just the shot out of the blue. And so I gave him $1,000. And what that did was the rest of my ninth step, it made every one of my amends, gave me a new place in the world where I could walk as a free man. It eliminated me looking over his shoulder, eliminated places that I was afraid to see somebody, because it got to the point where there was no place I was afraid to go, no person I was afraid to see, because I was ready to make the amends that I had to make with each one of them. And all this took place now, and by the time I got to this point, about 42 years ago. And for these 42 years, like I said, I've been able to walk the world a free man. I jumped into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous as soon as I had 6 months sobriety. My sponsor took me down to, called me up and told me, he says, be out in front of your apartment at 7 o'clock. He says, I'm going to pick you up. And so I got out in front of my apartment, and he took off driving down towards downtown. And I'd been on the phone with him a lot during that period of time, because I was starting to have some financial problems. I was starting to have some other things, and I was really kind of moaning and groaning about what was going on. And he says, I'm going to pick you up. So he heads off towards downtown. I said, where are we going? He said, we're going to take care of those problems you got. And so we're driving down. We get farther downtown. I said, where are we going? And he said, we're going to General Hospital. And I said, what for? And he said, I'm going to take you to the psych ward. And I said, whoa, Marv. I said, I know I'm kind of been ragging on you, but I'm not that bad. He said, no, but he said, we're going on a panel. And so we did, and we went on to panel at the psych ward down at General Hospital. And they had this tower building that was 5 stories out in the yard around the General Hospital. And you had to be cleared to get in the elevator at the bottom. You get up the top, and it's like a two-stage airlock where you get locked in the little cabinet before you can go into the where the psychos are. we're all psychos. So, and we finally get in there, and the guy that was leading the panel, he set us around and about some of us around different parts of the room. And then they brought all these people in from the psych ward in to sit amongst us, you know. And I was feeling a little bit uneasy about that, because I wasn't too sure about being around all these crazy people. And then this leader of the panel, a guy named Chick P, and he looks around at all these people and he says, He says, we're going to have this meeting here. And he says, they brought you in here because, he says, all of you people are crazy. And he says, I want to let you know, he says, right here and now, he says, that I'm probably the craziest one in here. I'm not crazier than any one of you people. And I thought, man, these people are going to kill us. But they're sitting there nodding their heads at him. And so we had that meeting, and I was uneasy during most of the meeting. I still didn't feel safe in there. And as we're walking out the door, finally after the meeting was over, and there was a lady that was sitting there in a wheelchair and had a cast on her leg, one leg popped up, and I started walking by the wheelchair, and she reached out and grabbed my arm. And when that happens in a psych ward, that's very disturbing. She held it for about 10 seconds. It seemed like a lot longer, and then she let go and we went on out. And my sponsor said, what was that about? And I said, I don't know, if she just grabbed me. And so we went on, and I was doing a lot of the stuff, going on panels, working with people. They started letting me doing things in my Arlington group meeting and leading meetings, things like that. And I was signing court cards, signing court cards at the podium after meeting. And this lady came up, she stood beside the podium. She was dressed very nicely, and I didn't recognize her as the lady that was from the hospital. She looked totally different. She was all put together and everything, and so I didn't recognize her at first. I kept looking at her. I said, "Who's from somewhere?" And finally, I said, "Do I know you from somewhere?" And she said, "Yeah." She said, "You came to the general hospital," she said, "when I was in the psych ward there." And she said, that was the first time that I ever heard anything that really made any sense to me. And she says, I haven't had a drink since. And I thought, to tell you that, I learned that night that I don't know who's going to hear what I say. See, I know that there's going to be people in the audience, the ears going to be open. I don't know who's going to really hear what I say. It's none of my business, see. My business is just to say what my experience is, to say what happened with me, see. And I've had things like that happen again and again in sobriety. And one of the most exciting things for me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is to be sitting across from some newcomer and listening to their stories and sharing my stories. And at some point during that sharing, you see a light start to come on in their eyes. And as you know, they're going to make it. They're going to be okay, because, and it's not me. It's just that at some point, maybe God talks a little bit to me, through me, to somebody else. See? Because none of the stuff, other than the experiences that I've had, other than the things that I've done, none of the things that I share with the newcomers is about me. It's about what's in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. See? I don't know, Bill Wilson didn't write this book. God wrote this book. Bill didn't even take the pen and put it down on paper. Bill walked around his office and his secretary wrote the book. Because Bill just walked around and dictated the book to him. And I think that at 3 years of sobriety, there's no way that any alcoholic with 3 years of sobriety can write this book. And I believe to the bottom of my soul that God wrote this book and Bill was simply the instrument. See? And it's just like this meeting tonight. In this meeting tonight, my story, none of the story has anything to do with anything that I did other than what I did wrong, other than what I did when I was drinking. None of the things I told about my recovery, none of the things I told you about any of the experiences I've had since I stopped drinking has anything to do with me. It has all to do with what God has done with me and through me. So, and I wish there was some way that I could just say, be sober. And if there was, I wouldn't do it, is it? Because everybody needs to have their own experience whatever it is, different from mine, whatever. Everybody needs to hear of their own personal experience, their own personal relationship with whatever higher power it is that comes into their life. Everybody needs to have that for themselves, because that's where sobriety comes from. See? And I don't know what anybody's higher power looks like. I don't know how to describe it. My higher power is not the God that my father worshipped. And I think that if I could describe to you and tell you what my higher power was, that it would ruin it. Because I think that any power that I have the ability to describe and to put a name on and to put an identity on is not going to be a high enough power to keep me sober. See, so I'm not going to look for a definition of my God. I'm not going to look for a personality of my God. My God simply is, and that's all. And I hope that each and every one of you has a God that is. And I hope that each and every one of you has somebody that you can share with that God and maybe see the lights come on in their eyes. And the only thing I have to say as we end here is please keep coming back. Because I need you more now than I needed you 42 years ago. Because when I walked into these rooms to stay 42 years ago, everything was gone. I had nothing left to lose. So when you've got nothing left to lose, it's easy to surrender. See? But I need you more today, because today my life is full. And if you don't stay in my life today, then I could lose that fullness. So please keep coming back.